It's good to be together tonight and to study together, to worship and to pray. If you want to open your Bibles, we're going to be focusing most of our time tonight in the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel, where we're going to read a couple of different passages in the first two or three chapters of 1 Samuel. And while you're opening there, as we've already said, glad everybody is here with us tonight, that we have this opportunity to worship. Sometimes we take for granted the fact that we have so many different blessings, including we have men who are so capable of helping us to sing together and pray together. I've said now for quite some time that there's certainly nothing wrong in public prayer with being more general. But I appreciate our brothers who lead us in prayer and choose quite frequently to be very specific in naming the people that we as a congregation have put on a list and said, these people need our help. These people are requesting our prayers. And I appreciate our brothers being willing and aware of that and trying to do what we can to encourage each other. I want to talk tonight about a man by the name of Eli. He is a man that appears in the Old Testament. He's one of the central characters in the first few chapters of the book of 1 Samuel. And Samuel, the prophet, the spokesman, the teacher, is the one who is required not only to write these messages and to convey the mistakes of a man by the name of Eli, but he's also someone who is going to share with us mistakes and successes made by individuals, because studying the Bible is partly looking at good men, good women, making good decisions and good choices. But sometimes we learn a lot by looking at people making bad choices, bad decisions, and reaping sometimes the consequences. And so what I would like for us to do tonight is to look at the first couple of chapters of 1 Samuel. And I want us to identify a couple of mistakes, two big mistakes that Eli chose to make. And then what I would like for us to do after spending 3, 4, 5 minutes on each of those mistakes is to walk away with three very simple practical applications. This is one of those classic studies or sermons where you take an Old Testament character, things that he did right or wrong, in this case wrong, and then figure out how we can learn from that. I want us to start here in chapter 2, and without doing any context, just look at verse 29. Because that's going to be the focus of what we're going to do. So we're going to start at the middle, then we'll come out. Verse 29 of 1 Samuel chapter 2 says, "Why do you," now this is Samuel, a spokesman for God speaking to Eli. We'll talk about who he is in just a moment. "Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering which I have commanded in my dwelling place, and honor your sons more than me, to make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of Israel, my people?" I'm convinced that even if we didn't know the story already, that we're smart enough and decent enough Bible students that we can already begin to put some things together, and probably we can make an educated guess as to what the complaint is that Samuel has against Eli. Sounds like, if we don't know anything else, Eli's made some bad judgments. He's probably not set the right example. He's probably maybe abused a privilege or allowed someone to abuse a privilege. Kicking at a sacrifice, that sounds like he's flaunting something, mockery, not taking it seriously. So this is one of those things where you can read the verse and say, that's probably what it is. But what we'll do is we're not going to back up and we'll figure out if our hypothesis is correct. To do so, we need to give a little bit of background and identify who Eli was. Let's go back to the first chapter of 1 Samuel, and we're going to read maybe a half a dozen verses or so, skipping around in the first couple chapters. And so it says here in chapter 1, beginning in verse 2, it says that this man had two wives. The name of one, this is verse 2 of chapter 1, was Hannah. The name of other, Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. We probably were already familiar with Hannah because Hannah becomes the focus of the first dozen verses of chapter 2. She's the woman who, like many other key women in the Old Testament, was barren, but she wanted to have a child. someone actually thinks that she has lost her mind or that she's been drinking because she's praying to herself. Her lips are moving, but she's not saying anything. And someone comes along and says she's completely lost her mind. That's what happens in chapter 2. It's kind of a little bit of a funny scene that gets painted. Then in verse 3, this man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Which, if you back up 6 weeks ago, we talked a lot about Shiloh, how it was such a significant city to the people of Israel. And it says, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. So it would make sense that the priests are going to be at the central location wherein worship is going to occur, because that's what has to happen. The priests are in charge of that worship. And so this is the first time that Eli, who is serving as a priest, is first mentioned as a priest. Then if you drop down to about verse 8, Elkanah, her husband, said to Hannah, "Why are you so upset? Why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" So here's kind of a classic. Aren't you happy enough being married to me? We don't have any children, but shouldn't I be enough to make you happy? And like many women, particularly at this time in this culture, no, I'm not happy. Honey, I love you, but I want kids. And my identity cannot be complete until I get kids. Verse 9. So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle to the Lord. And then we see where the focus then moves away pretty much from Eli and then begins to focus on Hannah, wherein Eli is now the one who says, "Why are you drinking? Why are you drunk?" And she says, "I'm not. I'm just praying, but my lips are moving and I'm not talking and it looks like I'm crazy." So Eli is this priest. Here's something else that I think sometimes we miss, and that is he was also a longtime judge of Israel. So you have to actually fast forward three chapters, over into chapter 4 in verse 18. It says, "Then it happened, when he had made mention of the ark of God," this is what we talked about a few weeks ago, "Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate after he had heard what his sons had done," more about that in a moment, "and his neck was broken and he died, for the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. This is where a little bit of Old Testament 101 or maybe 201 knowledge helps, in that before the kings, Saul, David, Solomon, Rehoboam, Jeroboam, and then all the others, before there were kings, there was no one in charge. Well, there was Moses, and then there was Joshua. But when Moses and Joshua pretty much left the stage, we were left wondering who's going to be in control. Eventually, the children of Israel said, "We want a king so that we can be like the other nations." But for a period of a few hundred years, they didn't have anyone. And so rather than there being an election every 4 years, or whether there being a king wherein it goes from son to son to son, God had a series of about a dozen men and one significant woman by the name of Deborah step up and be judges. Except rather than being judges wearing robes with a gavel deciding whether it is right or wrong, a more appropriate term may have very well been deliverers. Because these were men and one woman who, when the nation fell into disrepair as a result of their wrongdoing, they would come in, they would rescue the scene, they would make everything better. The people would say, "Hallelujah, God is great." And then they'd live righteously for a few years. Then they'd fall into decay. That judge would die and then another judge would have to come in. The most famous of those judges was, of course, Samson, or infamous, depending on how you like to word it. So that's kind of important to think. That Eli here is not just this priest, a religious leader. He's also in many ways kind of a political or military leader of the people. He is generally regarded as a good example. That is, if we were to do a complete study of the life of Eli, there's a lot of things about him, his character and the way that he approaches things that we can say, I appreciate the example that he set. For example, in chapter 3, if you go back and take the time to read, he was willing to listen to all that God had said to him. In chapter 4, we read that he was very dedicated to the idea of tabernacle worship or the Shiloh-based ark worship. So these are good qualities about him. That being said, he was not perfect. And what we want to focus on here is in chapter 2, verse 29, where we started, Samuel comes down pretty hard on him, and he says, I've got this against you, and you've made some serious mistakes that you have that you need to answer for. So I want to talk about those two mistakes, the first of which is kicking at the sacrifice. He says in verse 29, why do you, Eli, why do you, the priest, the judge, this spiritual man, this example, why are you kicking at my sacrifice and my offering? The "my" there in my Bible is capitalized because Samuel is not referencing a sacrifice to him, but he's talking about a sacrifice to God. What we have to appreciate is that if we back up about 12 to 14 verses, going back to the earlier part of chapter 2, that the two sons of Eli, who we were introduced to in chapter 1, Hophni and Phinehas, were clearly acting in very wicked terms. Now, before we go any further, let's make sure that, again, there's some good basic Bible principles we need to appreciate here. And one, we kind of hinted at it this morning when we talked about the parents' responsibility, is that parents are responsible for training and teaching and modeling behavior, but ultimately the child gets to choose what he or she wants to do. The kind of quintessential verse that we always point to is Ezekiel 18, where it says, no longer will the proverb be true that the fathers have eaten sour grapes and their children's teeth are set on edge, and indeed each person will die for his own sins. That is, you're responsible for you, I'm responsible for me. So this is not to say, well, why are you, preacher, talking about Hophni and Phinehas acting wickedly and saying that it's Eli's fault? Well, just give me a chance. Don't be so impatient. I'm kidding. You're listening here. But let's just see what happens here. Go back to verse 12. It says that the sons of Eli were corrupt. Okay, that's their fault. With an asterisk next to it or a footnote. Okay, they were corrupt. They did not know the Lord. Now that's an interesting statement. They should know the Lord. Even children who are disobedient should know the Lord. But just let that ponder in your head for a second. The priest's custom with the people, verse 13, was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged flesh hook in his hand while the meat was boiling. He would thrust it into the pan or the kettle or cauldron or the pot, wherever the meat was cooking, and the priest would take for himself all that the flesh hook brought up. So they did it in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. And before they burned the fat, the priest's servants would come and say to the man who sacrificed, give meat for roasting to the priest, for he will not take boiled meat from you, but raw. If we understand some of the fine print, which actually wasn't that fine print in the book of Leviticus, this is a big problem. There were specific models for how you go about sacrificing animals. What you did and the order in which you did it. The fat belonged to the Lord. And the idea of all of the backward sacrifice, as going back to the book of Leviticus, was keep the focus on God and never allow the focus to be on you as a human being. Otherwise, you'll give the lame, you'll give the sick, you'll give the decrepit. So God says, I don't want any of that. I want you to understand that the sacrifice must be a true sacrifice and not just, oh, that's convenient to give. Why? So that thousands of years later, you'll be able to fully appreciate the sacrifice I'm going to make and my son is going to make. All right, so verse 16. If the man said they should really burn the fat first, which would be a good thing, spiritually speaking, then you may take as much as your heart desires. He would then answer him, no, but you must give it now. And if not, I will take it by force. Now, I don't have to know that much about the role of priests or the fine print of sacrifices to know that that attitude is not a good one. If you don't do what I want you to do, I'll take it by force. Verse 17, therefore, the sin of the young men, Hophni and Phinehas, was very great before the Lord. And the reason is that these men abhorred the offering of the Lord. They're saying, look at us, we're good priests, but you got to do it on our terms. We want the best, and if you don't do it, we'll just take it from you by force. God says, that's not what I'm looking for in priests. Just because you wear the title priest doesn't make you special. You are a servant of mine, and I expect you to act in a certain way. And so, we won't take the time to do it, but I put down there a half a dozen verses or so in Leviticus chapter 3, Leviticus chapter 7, where you can read the fine print. And so you could go and you could draw arrows back and forth from Leviticus 3 and Leviticus 7 back to 1 Samuel chapter 2 and say, yep, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. Clear. And so in a court of law, what they were doing is guilty because it is a clear violation of passages written in black and white. No one debates that. But here's the thing. He comes along and the Samuel, the spokesman, says in verse 29, you kicked at my sacrifice. Well, that's kind of an interesting phrase because kicking at the sacrifice may not be something that we are familiar with. But what actually ends up happening here is he's using almost an analogy of what beasts would do or what cattle would do. And that is just like cattle might sometimes do. These sons of Eli were exhibiting a lack of appreciation for what they had been given. Rather than saying this is an incredible opportunity for me to serve God and I'll take what's given to me, no, I'm now going to take what's best for me. We sometimes joke about the fact that we haven't come real far in thousands of years, that there are religious groups today that pervert the sacrifices financially made on the part of congregations and benefit as a result of it to a gross and negligent and perverted degree, not appreciating what has been done. And you would expect maybe an animal that doesn't have the capacity to think right and wrong to do that. But you certainly wouldn't expect human beings, let alone would you expect men who are priests, let alone would that come from someone who had been trained by a father who was teaching them correctly. Or did he not fully teach them correctly? Is there something that he missed? More on that in just a moment. Mistake number two, as illustrated in verse 29, is he says, you are honoring your sons, Hophni and Phinehas, more than you are honoring God. So if you look at verse 29, there are two things he says you did wrong. You kicked at the sacrifice, and you honored your sons more than you honored me. The fact is Eli had made or put forth some, and I put that in italics, effort to influence his son in a positive way. How do I know that? Well, look at verse 22. It says that Eli was very old when he heard everything his sons did to all Israel. Did you notice the way that's phrased? It's not in all Israel. He did it to Israel. When they disobeyed God, they were harming not only God, they were harming his people. So God says, you may say it's not a big deal for you to pervert the sacrifice. Tell that to the people you're hurting because you're hurting them. When dad hears what his sons are doing and how they laid with the women who assembled, wait a minute now, we didn't read about that. Oh, you mean there's more that they're doing? Yeah, they're not just perverting the sacrifice. Now they're laying with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Okay, just pause for a second. Wednesday night class on Exodus. Remember all those weird things that God says don't do that didn't make any sense? It does make sense, because where did Hophni and Phinehas learn about laying with women outside of a temple? They got it from those foreign cultures that God said, stay away from. These are the temple prostitutes that he says in Exodus chapter 21, 22, 23. I don't want you having anything to do with that stuff. It'll just be a temptation to you. Keep the focus on me. It's amazing how if we do what God says, we avoid so many future problems. So, he said, guys, sons, Hophni, Phinehas, verse 23, why do you do such things? I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who's going to intercede for him? Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father because the Lord desired to kill them. The fact is he is stepping in to say, guys, this isn't that smart. This is not a wise move. You might say, well, why is he a bad guy? Why is that a mistake? Well, you have to read just a little bit further. Drop down to chapter 3. And in verse 11, The Lord says to Samuel, "Behold, I will do something in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle." Whenever God says, "I'm going to do something that's going to make your ears tingle," it's probably not a good thing. Verse 12. "In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end." That is, bad stuff's going to happen to Eli, his children, his grandchildren. Why? That's not very fair. After all, chapter 2, he was saying to his son, "Stop that." Oh, actually, he never did say stop that. He just said, "You shouldn't be doing that." Something to just ponder. He says in verse 13, or verse 12, "I have spoken to this house from beginning to end." Verse 13, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile." Now, that's very clear. And then notice those next six words. "And he did not restrain them." Verse 14 says, "Therefore, I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." Now the picture gets a little bit clearer. God is not saying that Eli the dad is responsible for the choices that his grown sons are making. God is saying, however, that Eli is responsible in part when he does not do everything within his power to stop them. There are a lot of things that we would like to control, and I would like to control, but we can't. But what is in our control, what we can do, the influence that we can have, that's where God says, "I expect you to do that." God does not expect us to control the rest of the world, but he does expect us to do what we can to influence. And when there is wrong, he doesn't expect us to say, "Well, you probably shouldn't be doing that." Now, there has to be some judgment. But the point is God says, "Eli, you did a good first step, but you didn't go far enough. You didn't restrain them." Now, I don't know exactly how old they are at this point. I don't know the kind of relationship they have. I don't think that what God is saying is that Eli was responsible for locking them into their rooms and taking away their video games and cell phones. I think he's saying that that wouldn't have done any good. But you could have done more, Eli, and you didn't. And as a result, there was no restraint. And because there was no restraint, they were allowed to do what they wanted. And because you weren't the person stopping them, or at least trying harder to stop them, they're in trouble for it. But you're in trouble for it as well. And in fact, their trouble is death. His trouble is death, albeit because he falls over, basically faints as a result of hearing this horrible, horrible news. He did not restrain them. Some versions say he did not rebuke them. And that's interesting, because sometimes it's not so much restraining, because again, you cannot take an adult human being and say, "You will come to church, you will stop going there, you will stop acting that way." But we can rebuke. We can say, "That is not right. That is wrong. That is not okay for you to be doing that." Well, let me conclude with very simple applications. I love studies like this, because here's this character that kind of gets lost in Scripture, Eli, Hophni, Phinehas. But there's some big things out of there. One kind of goes along with this morning. I didn't purposely plan these two together, but it just worked out that way. One is, it goes back to parents, that we have a responsibility to teach, and we have a responsibility to rebuke. I said this morning, I'm not a perfect parent, and if anybody is a perfect parent, I'd like to meet him or her, because you'd be the first person, I'm sure, to admit, yeah, we all make mistakes. We all say things that we should have done differently. But if we just teach, and we never correct or never rebuke, that's akin to God saying, "Well, here's the law, but do with it what you want. There'll never be punishment for it." Or that's the same thing as Congress saying, "Here are the laws." And when I say, "What happens if I don't obey them?" They say, "Nothing. We just don't like it." Well, that's not good for a society. That's not good for crime. That's not good for anybody. And so God understands that. So parents, we quoted Proverbs 22, verse 6, have the responsibility of training. But parents also have the responsibility of correcting. And it seems to me that the focus of Eli is that he did some training, but he really seemed to fail when it came time to correct. I mentioned three verses here that you can look at on your own. I just want to look at the middle one there, just very briefly, just to give you a flavor of what these passages are talking about. Proverbs talks a lot about correction, not just parents and child, but about we as humans needing rebuke, needing correction. We need to be told that's not right. You did it wrong and you need to change it. But here in Proverbs 23 and verse 13, do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. Now, there's all kinds of comical things that can be said and have been said about that and misinterpretations of that. But the key point of verse 13 is that if you do not correct a child, the child will not learn that that was wrong. And really, this is not so much just about children. If you do not correct an adult legally from time to time, he or she's not going to understand, I shouldn't do that again. It's not fun being in jail, or it's not fun getting a ticket for $300, or it's not enjoyable having a police officer stop you and make you late for work. Those are not enjoyable things. Therefore, I will not speed. I will not do this again. So we understand that. So we have that responsibility to be ready to rebuke from time to time and correct, but also to accept that. That being said, Hophni and Phinehas might have still sinned had Eli stepped in and done a better job. The fact is parents are responsible for a child's are not responsible to a degree, but yet are responsible. Parents are responsible for doing what God has asked. My point is when each of us stand before God on the day of judgment, we are going to be the ones who answer for the way that we've conducted ourselves. But we as parents will share some of that in the sense that we have to have at least done our part to try to get them as close as possible. Application number two is this, and this was one that really kind of struck out to me. Even when there is forgiveness, because God says, if you ask for forgiveness, I will forgive you, period. That's the way God is. Sin always comes with consequences. So you can sin and say, God, I am sorry, I should not have done that. And he says, I will forgive you. And then God may still say, but there are some consequences to your actions. The examples that we give, kind of silly ones from time to time, where if a person robs a bank and gets away with $100,000 and says, you know what, that was wrong, I shouldn't have done that, and goes to the church and says, I'm sorry, please forgive me. God's going to forgive that person. We're going to forgive that person. Everything's going to be wonderful. But then when that person goes to the judge and say, hey, I know that you sentenced me to 8 years in prison, but can I be out tomorrow because I've been forgiven? Well, the judge is going to say no, because there are still consequences to what you've done. I appreciate that you feel sorry about it, and I appreciate that you have that attitude, but you're still going to serve 8 years in prison. Okay, fine. We understand that. That is a just system. The same is true with God. Eli had done wrong. He had disappointed God. But the fact is as we proved with a couple of key verses, Eli had done a great deal that had pleased God. But even in spite of that, he paid for his sin in what we might call a rather violent matter. And so the thing is Eli does not have a perfect life even after he makes some sort of correction. We need to appreciate that another reason to not sin is there are usually earthly consequences. And what I mean by that is we do not sin, or we try not to sin, because we don't want to displease God. We want to go to heaven. We don't want to go to hell. Those are all legitimate reasons. But let's face it, virtually every choice that you and I make to sin on this earth has some sort of an earthly consequence. It may be criminal. It may be a relationship that's severed. It may be our reputation that has now been tainted. It may be you've lost a job. It may be that you've got demoted because you were dishonest. Those are real consequences in this life. And we have to understand that just because we are forgiven doesn't mean that we're not going to still have some payment for the choices that we have made. Thirdly and finally, we need to understand that putting God first, making him the number one priority, might be inconvenient, it might be painful, it might be costly. Because being faithful to God requires, as we said this morning, a willingness to say, I'm not about worldliness, but I am about godliness. The thing that I noticed in the text that we've studied tonight is that Eli was, shall we say, reluctant to fully stand up and to completely do what was right. He trained, He had a good start, but he did not restrain. He did not rebuke, because that was the hard part. God has not asked us to only do the easy parts, but he has actually asked us to do even the hard parts. And it reminds me of two passages in the New Testament. One is in Romans chapter 16, where the Apostle Paul says, "I want you, brethren, to note those who cause divisions that are contrary to the doctrine, and I want you to avoid them." This was the exact problem at the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians 5, where you have a man involved in sin, and rather than saying, "You are wrong, buddy, you have sinned. You are in danger of hellfire. You need to stop living that way." Instead of having that kind of guts, which is what they needed at Corinth, they coddled the guy. They said, "Oh, we don't want to offend him." They even went so far to say, "Yeah, he's in sin, but we like it because it looks like we're more accepting to the rest of the world." And Paul says, "You've got to be kidding me. Putting God first isn't easy. And sometimes it requires you to say some tough things. Because anyone in sin must recognize that he's in sin and then apply the things that unfortunately Eli was unwilling to apply." I'm convinced that if Eli were here tonight, I don't think he would be upset with this sermon. I don't think he'd be like, "You're bad-mouthing me." I think like any good parent, any good responsible Christian, he would say, "Learn from my mistakes so that you don't repeat them." We want that for our children. We want that for younger Christians that come after us. We don't want them to make the same kinds of mistakes. And Eli would say, "Yeah, I made those mistakes. I kicked at the sacrifice, allowed my children to do so. I did not restrain them. I did not teach them correctly. I honored them more than I did God. And boy, I paid for it. They paid for it. And I regret it." We can have a lot of mistakes and have a lot of regrets. Unfortunately, we do that. Fortunately, God has a lot of mercy, and he forgives us, and we're thankful for that. If you're here and you say, "Wait, man, I think I'm like Eli from time to time," then you're like the rest of us, making mistakes, having those regrets, realizing we should have done things differently. And if you're ready to make some sort of a commitment to make a change for the better, we would love the opportunity to help you in that. Hope these things are encouraging. If we can help to benefit you in any way, let us know while we stand and sing at this time.